You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network, on the internet, broadcasting from two shipping containers outside Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area, and this show aims to bring some culture to horticulture. So today, we have a really special guest with us, Richard Mabey, who is hailed as Britain's foremost nature writer. He is the author of the groundbreaking book on foraging in the countryside called Food for Free and the editor of the Oxford Book of Nature Writing. He has also narrated and produced popular BBC television and radio series and written for The Guardian, Granta, and other publications, and joined us from his home in England. Now, Richard has a new book called Weeds, in defense of nature's most unloved plants, which was just published this month by HarperCollins. Welcome, Richard.
Hello.
Hi, Richard.
So, Richard, we have wanted to do a show on weeds for a very long time, and we were sort of looking for just the right angle to kind of attack the topic. And when Alice and I saw your book last winter at a trade show, I knew that we had to have you on because we loved your fresh perspective on the topic. So we're
I'm very glad. I like talking about it.
Great.
So let's get right into some stories about these botanical thugs, shall we? So in your book, you review many different writers' definitions of a weed, many of which sort of view them from a human perspective. So tell us how you, Richard, would define the word weed.
Well, I would never use the word myself to insult a plant. But,
I was afraid you might say that.
Weeds are plants that other people don't like.
Right.
One's own weeds are very strange sometimes. I mean, in certain parts of the garden that I have, I discipline plants. and the ones that I remove probably wouldn't be the ones that would be expected by other gardeners. We've got quite a big and complicated garden here, and one end of it is allowed to develop in exactly the way that it wants to. So no plant is discouraged there at all. Part of it is going to natural forest. Another part is a kind of meadow. Closer you get to the house, the more organization and control there is.
Uh-huh.
And I have one of my favorite bits is a Mediterranean garden where I try and grow species that grow along in the Mediterranean climate zone, which Britain is increasingly becoming rather like. We've had 3 months of drought this spring, and my garden, that bit of the garden, absolutely bamped with wonderful lavenders and cistuses, and while the rest of the countryside was turning like the Kalahari Desert. But the things in that garden, which I regard as weeds, are very largely the ones that I planted myself, which so like the conditions there that they get out of hand. And what I want there, and it's far from a natural Mediterranean ecosystem, is as wide a species mix as I possibly can. Mm. But the euphorbias and the marjoram have other ideas, and some increasingly with the hot weather, so is the lavender. So seedlings are popping up all over the place of plants that are highly desirable to most gardens, including myself, but which I don't want smothering the other species that I want in there. So the subjectivity of this judgment one passes on intrusive plants, I mean, is the whole story in a way.
So what inspired you to write about them? What makes them fascinating to you?
Their tenacity?
Okay, well, let me switch to, at this point, to other people's definitions of weeds.
Right. Right.
I mean, what I like about category that most human cultures have put weeds into, it's precisely their cussedness. I've always admired, I mean, I got into writing about nature because I was blown away by the extent to which, when I was working in really quite inhospitable environments, I would see natural systems bucking the trends, actually surviving under the most appalling stresses, adapting, being fleet of foot. And I love this image of the natural world, or parts of it anyway, as real opportunist survivors. We've certainly, in the United Kingdom, we've got into a position where we assumed a very parental role towards nature. We assume it's fantastically tender and fragile and incapable of surviving without our help.
Right.
Now, I think that's patronizing and arrogant tripe. And the species which, amongst others, demonstrate the extent to which this is rubbish and is actually an insult to the durability of the natural world are weeds, because they precisely survive where we least want them. So even though one sees them most in situations where humans are at work, they are in that sense the very essence of wildness, because they refuse to play by our rules.
That's what I find, that the word wild very interesting, because in our practice here in New York, where we, you know, build gardens, many times people are looking for wildness, mm-hmm. and we're trying to create a kind of unnatural wildness. They want it to look like it's always been there. They want it to feel wild, you know. The people are craving that, Richard, you know.
Well, in wildness is the preservation of the world.
We're trying to do the same here, but yeah. There is a sort of philosophical contradiction there.
Right.
Cannot create wildness. Wildness is, by definition, is what it creates itself.
Exactly.
That would be my definition. I mean, as soon as it is a human system, however artful we are trying to be in saying, you know, we're trying to tease this into the condition of wildness, in fact, it isn't. It is precisely when things happen which you don't want to happen that the wild card is thrown into the ring.
Right. I find it really interesting, too, that you use the word discipline.
I'm going to use that word.
But that's a very man-made, you know, it's a philosophical term. So it's, and when you're applying it to a natural system, you know, it's like nails on a chalkboard, you know?
Well, one thing's of discipline.
Well, I think we should be honest about it. Yeah. That's what we're doing.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
We're wanting these plants to obey rules which we set for them.
Right, absolutely.
That is precisely discipline.
Right, right.
I always use, you know, I always see it used with regard to children, not so much with plants, but I like that.
So you describe in your book that weeds are human familiars. They go where we go, and we humans have had a symbiotic relationship with some of them, often finding uses for them. Can you give us some examples of that relationship?
Yes, almost back to the beginning. It's probably inconceivable that humans could have started farming unless there were already on the kind of cusp of that moment plants which were, as it were, offering themselves up.
Right.
plants which enjoyed the disturbance which transitional hunter-gatherers just about to turn into farmers were doing, you know, just building settlements long enough for the wild plants that they'd gathered to maybe sprout on their latrines and their dung heaps.
Right.
So the very beginnings of our relationship with plants in terms of eating them.
Yeah.
It is with weeds, plants which intruded into human settlements because we gave them, as it were, the an easy ride. But if you know, right down through history, there have been much more obviously practical uses for weeds.
The artichoke is an interesting.
One of my favourite weeds, and we share it because I think we it was one of the very many plants that English settlers took over to the States. Is a great bosky herbaceous weed called burdock.
Mm-hmm. Yes, burdock.
Big floppy leaves, which 18th century landscape painters adored putting in the foreground. But it also has wonderfully sticky burrs, which are the seed heads covered with curled spines.
Mm-hmm.
And they've evolved these in order that they can stick to passing animal fur.
Mm-hmm.
And get distributed. And in the 1940s, a Swiss inventor who'd been pondering ways of making fasteners suddenly had one of those revelatory moments and began the process of inventing Velcro.
Mm-hmm.
Based very precisely on the engineering of burdock seeds, weedy seeds, which were using one of the mechanisms that occurs right throughout the plant world of equipping seeds with hooks in order to get them distributed as far as possible.
Right. And I always think about that, you know, who was the first person to realize that an artichoke is edible? Because when you look at that plant, does not look edible, you know, but obviously somebody tried it way back when, and that was a brave soul.
I'm sure that's not the way it happens, though. You're talking about millions of years of experience here,
right.
And one knows that primates are very discriminating foragers,
mm-hmm.
not only for food plants, but for antibiotic plants as well. How they discover this, one doesn't know. But I mean, it's certainly a process of trial and error that began long before humans,
right.
And we were just kind of carrying it on. And the cultural transmission of information about what was edible and what wasn't edible amongst hunter-gatherers was fantastically sophisticated. It must have been, otherwise humans of any sort wouldn't have survived. So it happened long, long before anyone actually had to sort of look at a plant and say, you know, can I dare try that or not? I mean, the trials had already been done,
mm-hmm.
And the knowledge was being passed down.
Yeah, you speak in your book that the world was divided into two camps. The natural world became divided into two camps. Can you elaborate on that, at that turning point?
Once we became sort of farmers and started cultivating.
Well, yes, I mean, it doesn't make any sense to talk about weeds existing before human beings started cultivating their crops.
Right, right.
The word would not have had any meaning.
Right, yeah.
And so at the point at which, I mean, obviously it wouldn't have, you know, a single year or a single century, but during the period in which humans moved from being hunter-gatherers through pastoral gatherers to actual settled farmers, the fact of creating a plot of land on which you decided to grow one crop, philosophically, conceptually, then made any plant that intruded in that spot an undesirable, you know, which would later become called a weed. But it was actually more than that, because not only did the fact of cultivation create the conceptual idea of a weed as an intruder, but it actually ecologically created the conditions for this whole group of plants, most of which are plants which in the wild thrive in areas like volcanic scree or very unstable shorelines or floodplains, areas where the soil is in a state of continual disturbance and therefore long settled more temperamental plants aren't able to get a root hold. And as soon as human beings started first in the cultivated fields by digging them up, and later in transport systems and cities and whatever, creating facsimiles of these naturally disturbed areas, then, see, you know, the plants that thrived in those areas simply moved out into them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also found really interesting, so once we became farmers, you know, we the concept of weeds was kind of invented by ourselves, but the weeds of cultivation have survived and continue to survive our powers of eradication. And in the book, you say that weeds, as we define them, have a powerful tool for survival. That tool is their relationship with time. Can you give us some examples of how weeds use time to their advantage?
Yeah, the relationship with time is one of a multitude of devices which
sure.
weeds have. Basically, what they are trying to do is to mimic or even get one step ahead of the growth processes and structural forms of the crop plants that we want. And so to the extent to which a plant can, let's say, set its own seeds at the same time as the wheat is ripe in which it's growing, then it's going to has a better chance of being gathered up in the crop and therefore being sown again the next year. They also, as it were, transcend this by having immensely long potentials for dormancy. That is, the seeds which fall from weeds don't all germinate in the first year. The majority do, but
right.
there's a kind of logarithmic decline, so that in 100 years after, let's say, a poppy has shed its seeds, you know, maybe 0.2%. of the seeds are still germinating. Nobody's actually done an experiment long enough to find out what the limits of dormancy are.
But they're long. They're longer than we think.
Yeah, it is longer than we think.
Yeah, there were some interesting examples in your book of some seeds that were found in some disturbed areas and decades that were buried for decades, and then when the land.
There are plenty of. I'm sure there are from the States as well, but certainly over here that there have been cases of, let's say, archaeological digs from Anglo-Saxon sites
right.
and Roman sites where, as far as one can tell, the material that was brought to the surface is authentic. And you're having weeds. I'm reluctant to call them weeds. You're having old plants.
Right.
Germinate. Maybe 1-2,000 years after the time in which they were shed. It's very, very difficult to verify these things, of course.
Sure.
You know, the old stories of the wheat from mummies' tombs are
right.
now mostly discredited because it's believed they were taken in by grave robbers and wasn't an example of dormancy. But there are a lot of very convincing cases where ancient soil has been brought to the surface in what seems to be the first time, and plants have germinated from that soil.
We have to take a break right now. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about this because it's fascinating. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Richard, stay on the line. We're just taking a break, and we'll be right back.
Okay, lovely.
Welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Our guest today is Richard Mabey, preeminent nature writer and the author of the new book, Weeds, in defense of nature's most unloved plants.
That was actually a song, though. We have to mention the song that we just played called Poke Salad Annie, which is a very old song. Elvis did a rendition of it, but it was also mentioned in your book, Richard, which we found great. So we wanted to play it for the intermission. Richard?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Just making sure.
Like that.
Okay. One more thing I just wanted to touch on before we go to some further questions is there was just an exhibit here in New York called Manahatta, and some of that research was actually based on seeds that were found here in New York in soil samples, and they were able to geologically recreate what the island of Manhattan looked like at the time of Henry Hudson. And some of that was based on the seeds. And if you're interested, you can go to manahatta.org and actually put in addresses in Manhattan, and you can see geologically what the land looked like. And it's based on seeds and animal species that were here on the island at that time.
That's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
It was definitely greener.
The Second World War in Britain did much the same thing.
Right, right.
One of the stories I tell in my book is that a few decades before the Blitz on London in 1941, there'd been a great excavation. They were digging an enormous well to build a new brewery, and the pollen samples and seeds which came up gave a picture of what Britain had been like, what the vegetation of London had been like, 20,000 years ago.
Wow.
And all the species which were discovered hundreds of feet underneath the surface during that excavation came up after the Blitz. Now, whether they'd come from kind of ancestral relics of the ancient flora of a London before humans were there,
right,
or whether they just kind of drifted in from people's gardens is a moot point. But I think the dramatic lesson is there that there was a vegetation of highly adaptable open country plants in earlier times, and any kind of disturbance of the ground can actually bring these back.
Yes, it really is archaeology. Right.
Well, I have to ask you about, now, I know in your book you mentioned that in some areas of your garden you have a very laissez-faire attitude towards weeding, let's call it. However, there is one plant that you've named Grelda that you really can't live with in the garden. Tell our listeners about Grelda.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's my partner Polly's wonderful, inspired nickname for ground elder. You know, a brilliant contraction of the two words of that name, which makes it sound like a medieval witch.
Right.
That is trouble if you want to grow, let's say, a border of decorative perennials. It's okay in the rest of the garden. It's fantastically aggressive in garden borders, but it doesn't survive in shade. It doesn't survive in meadow conditions. So it really is in flower borders that it seems to like the particular kind of threadiness of root systems that you get there, and the kind of weeding that border gardeners do, because ground elder grows from tiniest little fragment of cut root. So if you think you're doing a good job weeding with your hoe and you're cutting the roots into thousands of pieces and you think you're killing it, in fact all you're doing is creating a wonderful nursery for a whole new generation of ground elder plants.
Yes. Richard, it would be fantastic to work alongside you in the garden. I that could be a lot of fun for an afternoon.
Polly did much. I describe in the book how we got rid of it from the herbaceous bed that we thought we did. I mean, it meant kind of 3 weeks of digging every single plant up and disentangling these entrails of white roots, which were absolutely entwined with the garden perennials roots. And you have to take them out by hand and then wash them and replant everything.
That sounded like an incredible job. I mean,
it's not an unfamiliar. I don't know if you have this plant out with you, but it's not an unfamiliar one with gardeners in Britain, who very often, if they've got a real, in invasion by ground elder, just having to rebuild the garden from scratch, you know, digging down 3 feet sometimes.
Yeah, I was going
to
say,
the place
and just
with
removing, and just removing, yeah.
Well, I have to, I want to talk to you, I want to talk a little bit about one of my plant enemies, bindweed, which kind of launches us a little bit into sort of the turf wars that you describe in your book are not just between humans and plants, but there are also considerable battles between plant species. Can you talk a little bit
about... bindweed, of course, is what can one make of it? I mean, it is one of the most extraordinarily clever plants on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And you have, I think you've got to admire it. Some of the ways in which bindweed copes with people's attempts to get rid of it are quite remarkable. It has five different modes of regeneration, you know, from seed to roots and all kinds of fragments and stem nodes in between. It has the capacity to find a source of light through a completely enclosed black maze with just one pinprick of light available at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
The most extraordinary story I heard about bindweed was that if field bindweed, which is kind of lower one, not the one that climbs over hedges, it's the one that is most common in arable fields, but if it gets into, let's say, a newly planted grass grazing field, it's learned to recognize the growth hormones in grazing cattle's breath and saliva, and can actually respond to them. So, you know, it's almost when the cattle move in, it's giving the weeds a dose of steroids, and they grow twice as fast.
Yeah, so it really has a symbiotic relationship then.
No, it's not really a symbiotic relationship because I suppose it is in a way because the cattle eat it, though I don't think they like it very much.
right.
Because it's got this kind of latex in it that I think they'll graze off the very young shoots, but that's enough to make it respond in two ways. Firstly, it starts spreading sideways and sending up multiple new growth nodes over a much bigger area. And as I said, it uses the growth hormones actually as a stimulant for its own growth.
Mm-hmm. That's so astounding.
It's trouble in the garden, but I suppose the point I'm making in my book is that as soon as you start to think about how weeds behave, why they're there, it may not stop you actually getting rid of them entirely, but I think it will say, well, these are very interesting plants. Can we reach a modus vivendi with them rather than spending enormous amounts of energy and colossal amounts of money on carbon-heavy herbicides.
Mm-hmm.
Can we work out a way of finding a corner for them? And and also, I suppose the main point. I mean, I may be kind of jumping too far ahead for you here, but I mean, it is we need to take responsibility for them. They don't come into our fields and our gardens in a kind of arbitrary way. They don't kind of drop from heaven. They're there because of what we do. And I think as soon as we realize that and say, okay, I've caused you, you know, you're almost one of our crop plants, I think our relationship with them has to change. It will still be necessary to remove them, but I think in a more kindly way.
That's really, really fascinating, which leads me to my next question. Richard, you just mentioned a phrase, you said trouble in the garden, which brings me to think about your chapter titled Knotgrass, Weed as Parable. You seem to be making an argument that man's turn to agriculture from hunter-gathering led to a monotheistic religion. And that's a really strong statement. And I think a lot about Eden and the apple and, you know, how man has from the beginning really tempted nature and taunted it. So where do weeds figure into that story as far as monotheism?
Okay. I don't think I actually say that. I was slightly surprised by your...
No, that's me saying Eden.
And what I really say is that the turn from hunter-gathering to agriculture, to being in charge of nature rather than, as it were, being at being a sort of kind of servant and follower of it, mm-hmm. Led to human-type gods replacing nature gods.
Mm-hmm.
I think monotheism
is
something quite different and was a very, very particular outcome of the experience of the early Jewish people.
Right.
But yeah, where do weeds figure in the story? I mean, no doubt Genesis is account of humans' fall. It makes clear that we not the two things were a punishment. Firstly, actually having to do farming itself was a punishment.
Yeah.
The sweat of the brow and all that stuff. But also the weeds that accompanied you and were created by the farming were a punishment. So you got it whichever way you went. There was no escape. Mm-hmm. And that was the kind of ultimate punishment. If you farmed weed free, you were getting punished. If you farmed with weeds, you were getting punished.
Right.
But I think to the extent to which one can kind of look at these early creation myths of an anthropologist, it's clear that learning that you could conjure plants you wanted out of the soil had a dramatic effect upon humans' view of themselves and their relationship to the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy to perhaps understand that at that point, the powerful nature gods were replaced
by
human gods.
Right.
As for weeds, they were there. What's very interesting to me is that the Genesis story was still being quoted by farm workers where I live in a quite remote part of the eastern part of British Isles. Up to 100 years ago, they were accepting that weeds were an entirely inevitable consequence of the fact of their tilling the soil and the fact of what their ancestors had done in the Garden of Eden. And they thought there was no way of ever getting rid of them. One just kind of lived with them. If just momentarily you discount the kind of religious angle of that, that's a very sensible kind of ecological position.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's that one I think we've lost. The inquisitiveness or curiosity about where weeds fit in the scheme of things and why they're there, we now just react to them with a knee-jerk, with a reflex, rather than actually thinking about what they are and where they've come from.
Mm-hmm. You there's always the phrase, you know, as described by Thoreau, as a weed is a plant whose virtues have not yet been discovered, which is what
it was not, or it was Emerson.
Emerson? Oh, okay.
Yeah,
Emerson.
Emerson made that. Was that man who said whose virtues had not yet been discovered?
Okay, Emerson.
It's an interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah, and then especially in comparison to Thomas Culpepper's Herbal, and you know that caused such a stir among physicians of the time. Wasn't that filled with local weeds?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
that's one of the reasons that caused such a stir, because mm-hmm. What Culpepper was doing. I mean, a lot of the book is complete nonsense and astrological spells and
yeah.
all kinds of things.
Right.
But at the very heart of the book was a kind of political attitude towards weeds, which and towards healing as well, which mm-hmm. said these mustn't be the preserve of the rich and the secretive, but should be available to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to Culpepper, the only people who could actually write about and dispense plant medicines were members of the College of Physicians, and it was almost kind of a Masonic society, very close
yeah.
and very jealous of people's intrusions, and the last thing they wanted was a kind of democratic attitude to healing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Culpepper did. He said, you know, it's everybody's right to
the masses, right.
So his book was was very cheap. It was filled with weeds that almost everybody could actually get their hands on. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that a lot of them may not have worked as well as he thought was another matter. But
right.
You know, he actually pioneered. He kind of broke down the sort of arrogance of the medical establishment at the time.
Well, he was. I guess it was kind of one of the first self-help books, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right, right. So let's talk about your work with Kew, the Royal Botanic Gardens. And what role have they played in the expansion of European power and also the expansion of certain favorite weeds, such as rhododendrons?
Yeah, I was surprised to read that rhododendrons were considered weedy, let's put it that way, in England. Is that we love them here.
yes. To come to why rhododendrons are here. Kew was a great kind of control center for organizing the British Empire's botanical resources throughout the globe. It moved plants about so that there were new plantations for British colonists to
mm-hmm.
grow.
Mm-hmm.
Most particularly, it moved quinine about because
right.
it was impossible for European settlers to survive in the tropics.
In the tropics, right.
Without something to counter malaria.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Kew's role as a kind of international Medicare thing for European settlers was absolutely paramount. But it was a role played by most of the botanic gardens in Europe. They were the nerve centres for the plants which Europeans exported and then grew in their colonies. You know, we kind of think of colonialism as you know, battles between you know, the indigenous peoples and you know, the foreign invaders, but when those battles were over, what really fixed the colonialists in their position was completely changing the vegetation of the country they had invaded, replacing it with their own vegetation, and the growing it in plantations. You know, Kew was a very, very powerful agent in this, in, you know, what one of your own ecologists has called ecological imperialism. Now, the rhododendron was a kind of movement the other way, because as well as I'm part of this movement of porting European crop plants into other parts of the world, of course, we were taking plants, healing them quite often from other parts of the world. Like rubber, and rhododendrons were one of the plants that the successive directors of Kew, the Hookers, brought back from the Himalayas, particularly, and they became fantastically popular plants in British gardens.
Mm-hmm.
But they very soon escaped, and what's happened is that a hybrid, which is quite unknown in nature. This was only discovered by DNA research in the last kind of couple of years, because everyone thought that the rhododendron that was starting to spread really, really aggressively through the wet western parts of Britain was the simple thing, Rhododendron pontica, but it isn't. It's now known to be a very, very complicated hybrid between some of the cultivated varieties, and that may be the reason why it is so aggressive, because it has that thing that botanists call hybrid vigor. And anyway, it may be a surprise to you, but I mean, in parts of the woodlands of Western Britain, which are sometimes called the Celtic rainforest, they're lovely, lovely damp Atlantic woods draped with lichens,
mm-hmm.
chiefly on oaks. Rhododendron adores that sort of climate, and it's remorselessly invading those oak woods, and has become, you know, quite monocultural in places.
Right.
And even I, who you know, don't like to write any plant off, think that rhododendron there is a bit of a menace.
Right, right. Well, yeah, it sounds like it's the kudzu of the South here in the States.
Yes. So we kind of have to wrap it up. I wish we could continue to talk some more. I kind of wanted to just end with a quote from your book that I found especially poignant. You say, and I quote, weeds, you say that the poppy is a motif throughout your book, for as a type, they are mobile, prolific, and genetically diverse. And I quote, they are unfussy about where they live, adapt quickly to environmental stress, use multiple strategies for getting their own way. It is curious that it took so long for us to realize that the species they most resemble is us. And I thought that was a good way to sort of end our show. And we thank you, Richard, for being with us. Buy the book. It's an excellent read. I learned so much, and we hope to have you on next time.
All right.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you for having
thank
me.
You. You've been listening to the Heritage Radio Network and We Dig Plants. Thanks to Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Our show is produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Jack Inslee as well. Please join us on our Facebook fan page, Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants. We'd love to get your feedback on our show. And also, we'd like to hear stories about your battles with weeds.
Happy gardening.